So I think I want to look ahead before we look back today. So let me the way I'm thinking about this is the question that I have on my mind is it finally the time for India? In the sense, is this the time where India is really going to have that exponential growth, or where it's really going to start shining? And the way, again, just to extend this analogy, the way I'm thinking about this is, if I can parallel this to, let's say, the AI revolution or the growth in AI, I think the field of AI, I think in the 1950s, 60s, it had like a decent growth. And then in the 80s, they had like AI winter where no progress took place. And then again, you know, late, early 2000s, there was rapid growth in artificial intelligence. And, you know, now every phone has like some piece of AI. So it feels like AI is finally here and there's no question about it. In the same way, if I look at, like, say, India's history, right? I think in the soon after independence, there was a lot of excitement for India. Didn't really pan out, in my opinion. Nothing really happened. 2003 also, I feel like, is one cutoff where there was this India Shining campaign, but also not really much happened, I feel. And here we are again in 2023, I think, 2 decades later. Is this finally the time where India shines and you know, becomes a global player or whatever it is? So how are you thinking about this?
Yeah, Dan, that's a good question. I think it also, we learn a lot in the process of answering that question as well. So it's good for us to keep reminding ourselves of what the answer is every so often. Now, I wear two hats. On the last conversation with you, if you remember, I spoke about how personally I had moved back to India after my education and working in the US for a few years. I have a number of personal motivations for why I'm back here building my career. But there's also another hat I wear. I'm also an investor by profession. Now, I lose money when I'm wrong. I lose money when my biases have withheld the reality from me, or I'm too far away from reality. I'm required by profession to be accurate about what I'm investing in and what I believe. So I'll wear both hats while I'm trying to explain that answer. And it's a very interesting journey of where we are in India today and why there are some things that are new now that we didn't have even like 10 years back. So zoom back to India, 1950. We had just finished our constitution. It had gone live. We had won our independence in 1947. Now, all of us have read the history. We've been taught in school. But India was a fairly difficult young nation, primarily because there's 1,000 years of civilizational wounds, a lot of scarring, a lot of people have been through hell. A lot of communities have been on the wrong side of history for 1,000 years. Lot of imperialism, a lot of obviously colonialism. So there's a lot of pain, and over 1,000 years of a lot of very different types of economic systems being applied upon this whole land, this whole, you know, civilizational construct, as it was called back then. It wasn't really one kingdom or one country back then, as we all know. But the economic systems that are run on this place, this geography, had very clearly been run with the goal of exploiting it. So specifically the experience we've had with colonialism. So we had to recover from a lot of things and reset an entire population, which is easier said than done, right? Now I'll skip the non-economic arguments and you know the criticisms, because a lot of things could have been done differently, obviously, with hindsight. But let's focus on the economic side of things. I think there were three fundamental issues with India's economy as we leapt forward from independence. Now, unfortunately, the first problem is that our first prime minister was trained in a school of economics called the Fabian School, which is fairly notorious for its very socialistic views of how to run a country, right? And as we've seen very clearly, socialism and communism, while very grand in theory, and I get the logic, reality and human beings as a species don't really work that way. And it's never been a productive system that gets the best out of people for the long term, right? It becomes a very zero-sumish game. And people in general want more freedoms. They don't like giving away control and being told what to do forever. So I think the socialist approach that we had, fundamentally, on principle, it was flawed. It clearly didn't work. We have the data for 50 years of that experiment running until 91, showing us that the experiment didn't work. But we refused to change our economic paradigm for, I think, too many decades. I think that was a mistake, and I'll explain the consequences of that. But that's the first mistake we made. The second mistake we made is we failed to understand the reality of our country. Now, India was, and this is proven by studies, many, many studies of India's economic history, but India was a fairly robust economic engine, very productive land, very entrepreneurial people. We had merchant navies that went to all parts of Asia and Europe. We had trading with the most distant civilizations on the corners of East Asia as well as Western Europe. And of course, the whole world, Columbus tried to come here, all that. So we know all these stories. Now, the fact it was so productive and the people were so very pro-trading, right, and running their own life, their own business, their own exports, their own production, everything from cloth and weaving to spices and finished goods, metals, jewelry, gold, and so on. India was a fairly great market economy for the longest period of its history. So to shut down the entire market and become a very command and control, licensed, Raj-run socialist economy was a very unnatural imposition on us as people. It robbed us of our basic, very natural instincts of being business people, of starting our own businesses, of running shops, running industry. So from the Kirana store to the largest, Tatas and whatever back then, every level of India's entrepreneurship, of India's economy, was stifled. And that was, I think, the worst thing you can do to a people of this land. It was a very unnatural imposition. And I think, honestly, a very irresponsible way of governing. If you ask me, we paid the price for 50 years.
Go ahead. I want to come in here. So in the sense that when you say imposition, the way I'm thinking about this is like, it doesn't feel like imposition in the sense that, I mean, these are all democratically elected governments, right? So it feels like even the people were somewhat like implicit in the self-torture per se, and the self-flagellation.
Do you ever remember having an election to pick the Congress as our government? Do you remember an election to pick Nehru as a prime ministerial candidate? Both were very clearly a small group of people deciding for the rest of us, right? I've asked my grandparents, who, by the way, we have elections now because I'm a kid, right? I explained this last time. Who teaches you how the country runs? Like your parents, your grandparents, right? Before school teaches you whatever. And you ask very simple questions as a kid. So, we elect our prime ministers. Okay, so who elected the first prime minister? Did you all go to elect? I asked my grandfather. He said, no, they just decided he's going to be prime minister. And the guy stood for 3 terms and we had no choice but to vote for him after that. Because there was really no one else to vote for, right? Everyone knew Nehru by word of mouth. Okay, Nehru's cha-cha-ji, et cetera, et cetera. Who's really a credible opposition to that guy back then? No one. So the answer is, yes, we may have seemed like a democracy by design, but there's a starting time for a democracy to become multi-party and a proper, vibrant electoral engine. We didn't have that for the first 10 to 15 years. And unfortunately, because we didn't, the checks and balances on any government's decisions on economic policy didn't exist, right? Now, there was a lot of pushback on why are we becoming socialist? Why are we becoming this and that? A lot of the industrialists were obviously very against their fundamental livelihoods being taken away from them. Now, I'm not saying we should become a full market economy like the US and give oil and mining and farmland and all this to 5 companies and make it a chaebolic economy like how some of the other countries in the world are running today. I'm not saying go the other way. I'm saying we define a path in the middle that allows what is natural to us as entrepreneurs, as people who build businesses every day. That's not new to India. And of course, the government wants some intervention, license, whatever you want to control something. Fine, bring in regulation. Let's talk about it. Let's find a reasonable middle ground. But we just swung the entire way, right? That is what is unnatural when I say that's an imposition.
So I want to stay here. I mean, you touched upon this thoroughly, but still, like, in the sense that, so my understanding is, I think the Indian economy from, I think, 47 to, I think, at least 67 grew at a rate of 3%, I think, which is very bad.
Yeah.
Like,
it's horrible.
It's very bad.
Our population grew at around 3.5 to 4.1%, and our economy grew 2.8 to 3.5%. So we weren't even growing the economy fast enough to meet the needs of our growing population. That's how bad it was.
Yeah. And the reforms did not, at least to my understanding, did not come until 91.
That's right.
So at least for my mind, as an outsider, as an observer, it just boggles my mind that for 5 decades, the leadership, even though looking at the results, and I think from the 80s, at least the neighboring China also was, I think from the 80s, at least neighboring China started to open up and started implementing free markets.
Right? The one party communism, like for them to change in the 80s or I think 70s, actually, they started working with the WTO partially and so on. For them to start before us is truly mind boggling. right?
Correct.
And I must interrupt here and say, it's not that we're idiots. It's not that Indians don't know how economics or how countries should be governed or what policies are good for economic growth or how to help a population of 700-800 million by the 90s, 80s, 90s to get jobs and create industry and so on and so forth. This is not a science that's unknown to us, right? This is purely a blame you put on leadership. It is a very tightly knit group of people who decided they know better than the rest of us, that they know what is good for us, that they will tell us how to live, that they will decide which companies should be started, government should run all the companies, government should decide how many people will be hired by those companies, government will set the rate for rice, for wheat, for imports, for gold, government will give you permission to have a bloody telephone line come to your house. Okay, this is garbage.
Mm-hmm.
This is absolute trash, right? And we have to be very clear in 2023 as people who are clearly building in a very different country, right? We have a very different experience growing up. But I don't know if you were old enough to remember those landline telephones and waiting for DD2 to come to your house and so on. I remember that stuff. I'm an early, late 80s, early 90s kid. We didn't have cable. We couldn't afford TV, nothing. All we could do was wait in line for 11 years for a telephone line. Okay. 11 years for a telephone line. Okay. And we have family all over the country and so on. It's excruciating to be told, oh, you guys have to wait. Why? Because who are you? Right? Are you some politician's fellow? Are you some this? Are you some that? Are you a Congress party worker? No. Okay. We wait in line. Right? Obnoxious. So I think we should not be charitable to people and their legacies when they think this way, and this is a disaster that they brought on all of us for no fault of our own.
So, you mentioned how it's not that our people are idiots. So I'm actually not sure about that, because if I understand correctly, I think even in 91, it was not like, I think people came to this realization that this system is not working and we have to reform. I think it was because that they were running out of foreign exchange reserves, that they had to kind of I think their hand was kind of forced into exactly. Implementing reforms.
Exactly.
It was not a realization. So, we did some searching and then we came to this realization, oh, okay, socialism is not working, let's do.
And exactly, that's the point I was going to make next. Even when we finally changed, right, and there's the same people in power, remember, the people in power have not changed for 50 years. It's the same people who changed the system, liberalized, so on and so forth. If you just dig in one layer, we spoke about this in the last conversation, just one layer from the mythology in the news and on Wikipedia, if you just dig one layer, it's not like they wanted to change and they realized the follies of their ways or something. It's not like they were suddenly enlightened people in power, right? They had no choice. They were literally painted into a corner and they said, okay, throw the towel in. I guess we have to open up the economy. I guess we don't know how to run an economy anymore. Let's allow companies. Let's allow this. Let's remove some licenses. Let's make the currency more free float. It really came down to being cornered to doing it, right? And now I have to ask a question to you, right? As a citizen of this country, and you have no control over any of this, it's like I have no control over any of this, right? I'm not a politician. You're not a politician. We're not the finance minister of the country. Are we okay with 25 or 50 people or whatever, n number of people in Delhi, deciding this kind of stuff for the rest of us? The answer is no, right? The answer is always no. We should be very, very eager to protect our freedoms, to protect our part to our own individual prosperities. What the system did is for 50 years, plus minus whatever, however you're counting, for 40 to 50 years, we had no control, no agency, no right to even ask for a part to prosperity. It was really devastating, right? And my grandparents lived through this. My parents lived through this. I have seen how much pain this causes when there's scarcity everywhere. And it's a total zero-sum game, right? It all depends on who you know and who's behind your licking in order to get a job, in order to get a reasonable wage, in order to get a landline to your house, in order to get permission for a loan to build, one more extra room because your family is growing. It's really painful. There is no freedom. I think that's a kind of society that we should hopefully never wish even on our worst enemies, but that's what we had until 1991.
One of the carryover of those times, I feel, is socialism. I also feel like socialism is this very, it's a very nice ideology to kind of believe in. I think there is this brotherhood feeling when you kind of, endorse that ideology or you believe in that ideology. And it can be very tempting, I feel. Do you think that even though we have maybe shifted the way we do things from the license Raj to a little more free market, do you think the DNA of our country, and by country I mean the population, and maybe if I can extend this, the young population, do you think they still have this love towards socialism? Do you think we are socialism comes to us by nature, or do you think, you know, we've kind of moved on from that period and we've realized our mistakes and we've realized the things that can happen and things that can go wrong from that time?
Yeah. Now, I've asked myself this question as well. I've reached an answer that's fairly straightforward. I don't think it's difficult to explain. Socialism, like you said, sounds nice in theory, but any exploration of the theory will show you that it's a very unnatural, pseudo-stable position for a group of people to be in, right? Socialism requires you to give up some of the control over your life. It requires you to give up some choice. It requires someone else to be a very benign controller of the rest of us, right? So the assumptions here are that you are okay giving up some freedom, you are okay giving up some agency, and someone else, some other set of human beings, we have to assume they're nice enough, benign enough, considerate enough of our beliefs, hopes, ambitions, dreams, that they will run this system for us the best way possible. Both sides of the assumptions make no sense. I am never willing to give up freedom or agency over my life, right? I don't want to be told to live a place. I don't want to be told to earn only this much. I don't want to be told I have only two options if I have to study or pick a degree or something. I want choice, right? I'm a human being. I get one life. I don't want anyone else to tell me, certainly a government, to tell me that these are my three or four choices only, right? Somehow they have assumed that they know better than me. And on the other side, the flip side, the people on the top, right? The people who get the power, who get control, we assume they're going to be benign and enlightened and educated and well off, and they will have our best intentions in mind. The honest answer is there have never been people in our species who have been benign and all of these things for long enough where they can pass on that system to a next set of benign people. Okay, power always corrupts. Power always takes over people. Power always makes them greedy, self-serving. And that's exactly what happened in India. It's not like we're special. We're also human beings, the same DNA in all of us, right? So I think socialism is a reasonable construct in a video game. It makes no sense in reality. Now, what did we need is a more important question, right? What actually works? I think there are some things in socialism that we desperately need in reality. We need, for example, a social safety net. In the US, they call it the social security welfare state, as they call it. We need some aspect of it in India, and we've had it from the start, of course, but we need some aspect to continue because we have hundreds of millions of poor people still, right? Now, they're not poor to the point of starving, of course. Our poverty indicators, you may have seen in the news, are much better in the last 20 years. Since liberalization 91, we've eradicated poverty faster than at any other point in our history in the previous 40 years, right? So again, opening up made it easier to become less poor also. You know, it's a very basic thing, but even that we need data to prove. So I think we still need a social safety net for people who are not made it yet. Okay, they don't have great education, have not had a full formal job. It is society's duty to take care of them. I believe that. Okay, so there needs to be some consideration. Therefore, taxes and cesses and so on. I get it. Okay, that's fine. That's a cost of living in an economy that's still making it. But I also don't want a fully capitalistic, only market-led system. Then it becomes a bunch of animals. They're usually cannibals. They just eat everything for the sake of profits. There's no consideration there at all. I don't trust markets to work entirely because I've seen people in power there also abuse markets, right? Just like in socialism, the people on top eventually abuse power and control. So I don't trust markets also fully. I want regulation. I want government to set the boundaries. I need reasonable limitations on market control also, right? So the answer is practically in reality, which is where we all live finally. We need a number of things from each of these systems to come in, a superposition of these things, so that a practical way of living with freedoms ensured to us as individuals, but prosperity for all eventually, right, and a path to it for all of us, we need a blend of that, right? It's a stack of things that have to work together. Now there we can debate, okay, whose idea is better for this part of the stack or that part of the stack and so on. Is 30% tax or 20% tax or 10% tax? I'm fine. I want democracies to debate that stuff. You want some other government in power, they change it, fine. That's okay, right? But what we had for the first 10, 15 years, I don't think, I have already said this before, I don't think that was a system that could have decided for us, taking our input. It's just a few people who decided what they wanted for the rest of us themselves. So there's a clear distinction here between the time periods as well.
What country do you think the system that you might have in mind, what country today do you think
none.
Is very none, none. Is it?
None. I don't think there's a perfect system, right? And I don't think any country has stumbled onto a reasonably efficient system from the first choice. Everyone, all these countries are finding their path, right? So, for example, the US, we are taught it's a very market-led system, but they've got one of the largest social nets in economic history. Their medical care costs are amongst the highest in the world, and a lot of Medicare, Medicaid, so on. They have a lot of government insurance-led programs for healthcare. They also have the biggest economy in the world, the most successful tech companies in the world. So they've done a lot of things right on the market side as well, right? But is the American economy perfect today? No. There are a lot of things that are broken, a lot of things that are not working. Clearly, their politics is going through a large amount of transformation. So it's not like I have any aspiration for India to be the US or China, which is the other way, communism and so on, or like Scandinavia or like Singapore. I don't think there is really any template for India to follow. People, for example, tell us we should be more like Singapore. Now, Singapore's population is a third of that of Bangalore. Right? Bangalore's GDP is $180 billion when we have three times the population. It's nice, I don't know if you've been to Singapore, it's a nice place to visit, very orderly, very clean, no chewing gum, all the mythology is nice. But if you try to take that system to a country of 1.5 billion people, you're going to be laughed out of the room. It doesn't work, right? So we also have unique challenges at this population scale. And therefore, I'm of the firm opinion we need healthy democracies that we elect on our own, like we have today. I'm very happy to say I'm very pleased with our democracy. It works to a large extent. But we need better quality leaders, right? We need more meritocratic. We have a lot of reservation and so on. We need more meritocracy in our governance. Of our citizens' views to be taken into policy writing, which does not happen always. So I think we have a lot of gaps, but I'm happy that we're making at least a trend in the right direction.
I was actually thinking about the Scandinavian case where, in general, not GDP per se, but in terms of like happiness indicators are generally on top and their per capita income is generally on top. But I think when you mentioned, and also these countries generally have a very high taxation, I think north of 60%, if I'm not wrong, personal income taxes. But I think where you mentioned about the population, I don't think that, not sure if such models might really scale up to like 1.3 million people. Yeah, that's
no, it's a fair question. I've also thought about the Scandinavian countries. First of all, they have massive oil reserves, right? Which as a general person, you'll never hear about. Okay, where do these countries make their money from? It's not just from taxes, it's from natural resources, right? And they are the first proponents of saying ESG and decarbonization and move to renewables, blah, blah, blah. But they're also minting like billions of dollars every day selling oil, right? So there's a lot of things that, like I said, between the narrative and reality, there's a lot of things that you'll discover as you dive into anyone, what anyone is saying. But yes, so they have natural resources, which is great. It's their advantage. They have a very small population, so that's been very comfortable to work with. But therefore, they could decide a very utilitarian approach to governing, right? Very high taxes, a little bit more command and control, social security nets everywhere, etc. But the downside now is the government can come and take away your child from you at any point in time. The neighbors complain, they can come and take away your children from you. Okay? Like I told you this before, like I would like poke the eyes out of someone if they touch my kids, take them away from me. So there's no way in hell I'm going to allow anything like that to happen on my personal freedoms. But that's that you're signing up for that in any of these countries by default, if you move there or if you're born there. Second, your education is free, right? But now they're playing games with 50% quota for women, 50% quota for men. Only these many women can come here, these many men can come here. They're trying to now become a very controlled, they're trying to impose control and balance when it's not really natural for that balance to be there, right? You're never going to have as many male nurses as female. Men don't want to be nurses. Why are you forcing them to, right? You're never going to have as many women in an army as you're going to have men, right? Unless you force it. And that's also obviously not working for any army in the world. So I think there's a lot of things here that they're trying out of ideology that is now showing very clear breaks in society. All those four countries, how many there are in Scandinavia, the extreme right, the very right-wing, ultra-nationalist type parties are all gaining hundreds and thousands of more followers and votes every election. Because clearly the people are now rejecting this very ultra left wing, you know, command and control type authoritative way of running government, right? So even they are going through obviously a lot of challenges. That system does not work long term.
I didn't know that Scandinavia had gone woke, but okay.
No, it's the most woke out there.
Okay. So I think you touched on the pop. So I think I have to bring up population at this point. To set some context here, the way I'm thinking about this is like, so besides China, I mean, so my understanding is like China is the most populous with 1.3, close to 1.3, 1.4. And I think India is the most populous with 1.4 and China is second. Yeah. And I think US is, if I'm not wrong, the third with half that, I think, about 400 million people. Like.
360 million people.
Okay, around 350, between 350 to 400. So, in terms of like, the systems of governance that we might have, I don't know, I'm just thinking about like 1.4 billion people and democracy. I don't know, do you think we have to rethink things at a fundamental level for this level of population? Or do you think these kind of systems that we already have, do you think they scale well in your opinion? I don't know. Like, even I'm confused actually a little bit.
No, it's a good question. So I've actually been hearing a lot of people discussing this, even in my circles, investing in tech and so on. So historically, the US has been the best place to be, right? Everyone aspired to be in the US. Their TV shows run the world. Their music runs the world. Their culture runs the world. The dollar runs the world very clearly. And they printed anytime they wanted, want more of it. And their politics has kind of become a template, the two-party thing, right? This grand circus every 4 or 5 years. It's become kind of the template for what a successful democracy should look like, right? So you're not surprised. A lot of European countries also now have two major, like UK has two major parties. They have 4 or 5, but it broadly becomes two, right? And India for the longest time had a lot of parties, regional parties, like every state has its own parties and many, many parties fight and coalitions change all the time. But if you notice in the last 20 years, we also become kind of a broadly two-sided system, right? So democracy is also mutated from this many party, you know, a lot of voices, consensus by a lot of debate and discussion and by winning consensus. Now it's become this or that. It's become very binary, right? And India is also getting there. I don't think we're fully binary yet. A lot of states are complicated and they will remain complicated at least in the next 10 to 15 years. But definitely at the center level, it's almost become very personality right now, right? We almost look like a presidential system where we're voting for a guy and his party, not necessarily a local candidate, whatever. So people have written about this. You know, I'm not a political scientist, but I get the logic here. But clearly, the trend is in that way. Now, China is the only like narrative violation here, where they are clearly not a democracy. Also, a very large country, extremely difficult to pull off what China did. But you know, I disagree with the system. But hats off, it's their country, it's their system. They can decide for themselves. I'm no one to tell them what to do. But they pulled it off, right? And what did they pull off? They became amongst the richest countries in the world by total country GDP, but also by per capita GDP, they were able to diffuse a lot of that economic value creation to the bottom of the pyramid. So they moved hundreds of millions of people from the fields and the west of China to the east, to the coast. They all got manufacturing jobs working for Foxconn and all these things, making phones and laptops and clothes and whatever. So they invested very heavily in manufacturing to get a lot of people off the agricultural income stream into manufacturing and services and so on, right? They also control their population, and they could do that because that's their system. They could just tell you, you cannot have more than one kid anymore, right? So a big imposition of freedom on people. They took away a very basic human right, how many kids you can have. So now the combination of both has really worked for them, right? Could they have done this without the one-child policy? I don't know. There's a lot of people have run scenarios. It would have been much more difficult. Could they have done this? Now, there's allegations that they've stolen IP, they've stolen patents, they've stolen processes. Could they have done this without the West's help? Unlikely, right? They invited the West to invest, bring their fabs, their manufacturing, their skilled, their IP. They stole the train designs from Germany. So all of this has been written about, YouTube videos about it. So clearly, their part to becoming prosperous as an economy has been a very differentiated one. I'm also very clear, India will never be able to do that. Okay, so we can't sit here and wish and hope that we can be like China. That's a nonsense wish in the first place. And even if we should, I debate whether we should, but even if we should, we can't. Practically, we can't. So now, where is all this going is the most interesting question. Now the most left field kind of view I've heard is that we're heading towards a very two level type democracy, where we might eventually one day all of us say, look, people are imperfect running such a large complex system of people, because people are inherently corruptible, etc. I mentioned this before. If we're all okay giving an objective artificial intelligence the power to decide upon objective matters, right? What should the tax rate be? What should the land rate be? What should this rate be? What should border? How should borders be controlled? What's the right number of visas to give out every year for immigration? Like, there are a lot of quantitative aspects of policy making that, you know, you could give it to a smart machine to do. Okay. And therefore, a number of things that get decided in democracy can no longer be part of the voting process. Give it to a smart, really biased AI system. Okay. I'm saying theoretically, I'm just giving you what this possible future looks like. And the other stuff, you know, like, you know, who should control temples, and, you know, give me an example. These are all very big topics of discussion in India today. The Ayodhya land issue, all this very like gory shit, right? Like, this is all lobbies fighting against each other, has to go to court, etc. Their AI systems cannot decide because they don't have historical context, is that they don't have any belief systems. So there, it's still a very people subjective, you know, very personal, emotional kind of decision making. Leave that to people, right? Let the people you vote into power run. So you're not hoping and praying, finally, the people I elect are going to be smart and make the best decisions. Let the smartest system do it. The other stuff, I want to vote for people who will decide a certain way that I believe. Right? That's what democracy is. Mm-hmm. So I think where one version of a future is, we head into this two-level type governance. We have permanent government. AI is permanent government. We have elected government. And we can decide to update the software, whatever the parameters, through our elected government. Again, I think it's wishful thinking. It's hard for me as a human being to assume human beings are going to be this efficient at scale. But that's, you know, one interesting possible future. Practically, I'm not holding my breath for any of these changes for my lifetime, for sure.
I was a little, taken back is a strong word, but I was a little confused when you said, we won't be like China as well. I don't know what you meant by that. So in the sense that the way I was thinking about it was, so there is US, which is the largest economy in the world, I think. Then there is China, both countries are doing exceptionally well. Per capita income wise, obviously US is doing much better than China. Long way to go for China and India as well. But I was I thought the direction is obviously that we have to reach China's per capita GDP and then per capita and then exceed that and maybe even reach US levels as well. So I'm a little confused when you said, you know, we won't be like China, very difficult. Is that like, are you talking about like time frame where it's very difficult in our generation or maybe the next two generations as well to reach that stage? Could you maybe a little bit on that?
Of course. I'll be more specific. So what China has done is they've gone from sub 1 billion in GDP, right, in the 80s to, what is it, almost 18 trillion dollars in GDP in around 35 years. Okay. So 40 years. 40 years now. They started earlier than us. They've compounded at around 8.5% a year. Okay. That is friggin' unbelievable. No country in the world has grown like that for that long. It's really incredible. Now, India has got a late start, 91, right? At 91, we were 225 billion in GDP. I still remember these numbers. In 2023, we are 3.4 trillion, right? We have grown almost 15x, 15 times, 1,500% in 30 years, roughly, 32 years. We have compounded at 8.1%. That's not bad. Okay, that's really not bad. I mean, I was surprised when I saw, holy shit, we're actually not too far away from China. But they have been compounding for longer. So they have a running start. They're further ahead. And you know how compounding works. It's accretive. You get an early start. It gets harder and harder to catch up with you unless you grow faster than them. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So now, are we going to grow faster than them? Yes, they're going through some trouble now. They have to rewrite as an economy. Yes, the next 3-4 years, maybe we grow faster. Right? Very good chance. But we have to grow faster for 20 years to catch up. Okay? And I do not trust inherently a democratic system to be consistent for 20 years, because economic policies change very quickly when the party in power changes, right? So no one is going to say for sure our policies will remain the same for 20 years. They've been very good, very pro-growth policies for the most part from 2014 to 2024, but no guarantee it'll be that way from 2024 to 2044. Now, the good thing is a lot of the accumulative advantages we needed as a country, right? For example, we needed better quality education. We needed more stable energy prices. We needed better productivity from the land. We needed a larger financial system. We needed a better way to get money from the government to people directly as when subsidies are announced. Right? There was a lot of leakage in the middle, a lot of graft, a lot of corruption. Now, thankfully, the last 10 years, we've done all that. Okay, so we've got Aadhaar, UPI, we've got direct Jan Dhan bank accounts, we've got the country has issued $200 billion of subsidies for COVID. All that has gone from government's bank account to your individual bank account or to a ration card type account that goes into your LPG gas cylinder or whatever. So suddenly subsidies are 100% more efficient. Okay, there's almost no wastage. That's huge. Okay, that no one predicted that would happen in India, but that in one system, with one series of India stack decisions, all this has become a reality. Second, very interesting thing, we finally got a whole bunch of our companies to become much more efficient, better governed, and suddenly we have the fourth largest bank in the world, the three top IT companies in the world, some of the biggest specialty chemical companies in the world, some of the biggest lending companies in the world, construction companies, infra companies, in almost every one of those very important industries, suddenly our companies are reasonably large, biggest amongst the biggest in Asia, definitely amongst the biggest in the world, right? So suddenly this very radical notion of 1991, just let the company start, just let them be, right? Allow companies to exist, allow private entrepreneurship to flourish. In 30 years, we become damn good at it, okay? Faster than anyone predicted. So long story short, a lot of other things have gone right, but long story short, we've done incredibly well for the last 30 years, right? But to catch up with China is a tough task. I think it'll take us more time. I'm not saying I'm a China fan. I'm not saying I don't want to, right? I would love to be number two in the world. But we have to be realistic. Our war is to be the third most powerful country in our lifetimes. Okay, today we're the fifth largest country in the world, economy. Japan and Germany are around 4.2, 4.3 trillion. Once we get to 5, we'll be the third largest. The other two will be past 20 by then, right? So from 5 trillion to 20 trillion is going to take a long time to catch up. Okay. So I don't expect we'll beat China too soon, but definitely as an aspiration for my son's generation, sure. I think that's a good aspiration to have.
The largest economy in the world, the second largest, I think that sounds really fancy. I feel at the end of the day, it boils down ultimately to like per capita income, right? I mean, that's the holy grail, right? Largest, third largest, but if I think right now India's GDP is per capita is everything $3,000, which is like very bad. So I think the holy grail at the end of the day is obviously
less than 3,000. I agree with you. Look, we are a poor country. Sorry, we were a devastatingly poor country. Okay, if you look at a few studies that have tried to analyze where did all the money in India go, we were reasonably wealthy in 1400, 1500, from 1500 to independence 1947. This place got pillaged, ransacked, raped. Like, it was horrible, right? What happened? I mean, we all know our history. Where did the money go? Just one estimate puts that at $45 trillion that's been taken out of India and gone to the UK and Portugal and whatever, the 3-4 countries, all the East India companies. That's a lot of money, $45 trillion. UK can never pay that back to us. Their economy is $2.5 trillion, I think around $3 trillion now. It'll take them 15 years to just pay back India for what they took, even if they could pay their entire GDP every year, which they can't, obviously. Mm-hmm. So I think the volume of wealth that left India, I don't think any of us, we are not taught that, by the way. Our history, the first thing our history textbook should say is, guys, welcome, you're a citizen of India, here's how much you were looted. This explains a lot about why your country sucks for a lot of people, even today, right? But that's never taught to you. Right, and we could have cut a deal with Britain when they left. They could have paid us reparations. They could have sent back some of the infra. They could have given back the currency that they had kept in escrow. A lot of the taxes that were in India, Nehru allowed them to take that money out of India. Even though once you are no longer a colonist, leave the money here. It's not yours, right? But they were allowed to take it back. We've been too gracious in the exit also, Okay, which is, I think, very silly. Economically, it's a very silly thing to do. So a lot of reasons explain why we were poor. And it takes a long time to come out of that, Ryan. To ask a country like India, as broken as it was left, in 50 years, get your shit together. You are the third most populous country in the world. Why aren't you the third largest economy already? It's a logical question to ask, but it takes a long time to come back from negative 45 trillion to whatever, 3 trillion, 4 trillion, whatever we are today, right? Over obviously, 500 years. So I think I have to be sympathetic to my country, objectively. I also have to be realistic from how economics works. We can't make illogical demands of this country. Now, what is our rightful place? I think for my lifetime, number three. Given the reality, given what I know, number three is damn good. I would like to see a per capita of $10,000 per Indian by the time I'm no longer on the planet. So from $2,400 today to $10,000, $12,000, I think it's a fantastic time to be Indian. That will be, we would have never seen wealth creation like this happen before. We will also never see, so it's we're growing 5x, right? From 2000 to 10,000, rounding down, 5x, 500%, right? Will we grow from 10,000 to 50,000 as fast? No, it'll take a lot more time. So the next 5x is quite hard, but this 5x is going to be something. It's going to be very interesting times for us.
I really want to move on, but I think I have to stay here for a second here.
Please.
So I want to set some context. So obviously my knowledge on this is kind of limited, but I'm not actually convinced with the, I have not been convinced with the argument of like the British rule being like a huge factor in the poorness of India. Where I'll meet halfway is like, I do agree that's obviously one factor for sure. But I'm not convinced that the reason that we've been poor for so long, I feel that blame squarely has to come after post-independence and maybe the first three decades or four decades. I feel I give more weightage to that than, let's say, the 100 years before that. So one of the reasons, partly is because, I mean, the British, I feel they obviously mismanaged. One is, I think, textiles. And textile, I think, is the classic example where I think there was a lot of textiles that were bought in from the UK, which kind of devastated Indian industries. But I'm not sure the extent of the damage that they could have done, to which we can say that we are still poor in 2023 due to that. So I have not been very convinced with, I always felt that, obviously damage was done, but to the extent that, even today we are still thinking about that, I'm not very convinced. Am I going somewhere wrong here?
I'll explain the economic argument, right? Do you feel somewhat miserable as a person? What is your emotional response to this? I don't care. I mean, you don't care about my emotions. I don't care about yours, right? That's only an individual's problem. So the emotional side, leave it aside. Okay. Economically, what did the East India Company do? And this is the interesting thing about how to take over a country, right? So let me forget I'm an Indian for a minute. If I am a mercenary for the East India Company, right? I'm an economic mercenary. And think of me as an investment banker for the EIC. I look at India, I land on one of the coasts, I look at India and say, okay, this place, fantastic. It's productive. It's got a lot of stuff Europe needs. I can make a killing being a middleman, taking stuff here, back there, right? So the first V1 of EIC were this middlemen, traders, right? Come here, buy stuff, go back to Europe, sell it there, make money. And they made absurd amounts of money, right? So once they started building that channel, it's called a channel, right? A trading channel. What do? They said, okay, you know what? Now, actually, anyone can start a shipping company to take stuff from India to the UK, right? We should go to the king of our country, go to the king of the UK, and say, give us by royal decree the exclusive channel ownership of the path from India to UK, which is what they did, by the way. Okay, and they had shareholders and so on. They were very political about how they did it. If you read the history of the East India Company, I actually have, coincidentally, a book here called Empire Incorporated. Exactly how this works. Buy this book; it's really interesting. So I'm speaking from having read people who actually studied how to build a great exploitative company like this. I would love to be a shareholder of an East India Company type company. Okay. You'll make a lot of money, obviously, right? Are they doing something wrong? Is there something philosophically incorrect? Yes, of course, all that aside, right? It's a great stock to own. That's one part of the reality, right? So how is the stock built? That's what I'm explaining. So exclusive channel ownership. Third, they started realizing, okay, you know what? Now we're exclusive from the UK. We should also start being exclusive from other countries in Europe. Why are the Dutch and the Portuguese and the Spanish allowed to come here? We should go talk to the king of Calicut, the king of this, the king of that, the king of Bengal, whatever. Start becoming their favorite traders. Okay, and start convincing them, don't trade with anyone else, trade only with us. So V3 of EIC was pushing the other European trading companies out. So the Dutch were relegated to one part of Cochin and then kicked out by one of the Cochin kings. A big war. We're not taught in our history. He single-handedly defeated the Dutch, right? Kicked them out of India for forever. The French were relegated to Pondicherry on the east coast. They were relegated to that one port. I think the Portuguese were stuck to Goa. So the British kind of took over exclusivity of trading with most of productive India. Okay, that's version 3. And version 4, very naturally now, okay? Every step is a logical step. Okay, look, we got exclusive relationships now with most of productive India. Our competitors from UK and the rest of Europe are now relegated away or not allowed to come here. What next? By the way, these Indians fight a lot. They seem to have a fairly weak kingdom on the north. The Mughals, by then, you know, were in really bad shape. They lost a lot of wars. They were losing land size, the Ahoms and so on. A lot of rebellion, right? Obviously, the Mughal rule was also not great for us. That's a separate part of Indian history. But it's not surprising now that these EIC guys decided, you know what, we can actually take this whole place over. We should also collect tax on this place. So let's double dip. Let's not just own buying stuff from India and taking it to Europe. Let's also own the production of stuff in India and then tax people who are producing it for us. So make money 3 times. Okay, I'll explain how that works. So that was version 4, and they did. They took over Bengal. They took over this. They took over that. They insurrected people. You've read all this now. The Panipat battles we've lost with the Mughals, but we've lost other battles with the British. Interestingly, you have to remind yourself now, Ryan, in school, you were taught all the battles we lost. You were not taught all the battles we won. Okay. So if there's one thing you know about your history, because you went to school like I did, you know we lost all these things. Okay. That you know as fact. What we know is what is the economic argument behind all this. So now the British runs a large part of India, and clearly they get the taste of running India. They love it, right? They're the masters, and they're having a great time, and everyone can be a slave. And interestingly, Indians are very good at running the administrative services for you. You can actually do less work running this country if you make more Indians run the place for you, which is what they did with their delegate kings and so on and so forth, right? Everyone became a delegate to the British East India Company. Version 5, the King of England suddenly realizes, buddy, I think we made these East India guys too powerful. They're now running an entire country. What the hell? I'm the king. I'm supposed to be running lands, not them. This is a company. So, you know, the economic history of EIC is that they eventually had to hand over the company to the crown. So we became a kingdom, a delegate colony of the Crown of England. We were no longer a colony of the East India Company, right? Mm-hmm. So we went from producers, manufacturers, suppliers of the East India Company, and they had to win our trust from when they landed here, to now these guys run our country. Okay. And remember, I've explained to you in 5 versions, very natural, logical progression from one guy in the channel to running the country. Okay. You and I would do the same thing if we were working for this company back then. Okay. So now I don't blame them. I mean, I told you, leave the emotional argument out. This is pure economic action at work. Now, once they run this entire country, how do they loot this place? Okay. Remember, they are not running this place for the sake of building it into a prosperous country. Okay. Mm-hmm. I hope now you understand their purpose here is to rape this place and make money from themselves and make money for themselves in Europe also. It is therefore a zero-sum game of taking shit out of India for themselves. Okay. This is where you conflate and you lose a logical progression. Everyone is told in India, oh, they actually developed India to make life better here for people. No, they don't. They don't give a damn about India. No one does. Okay. If you're running any country, any company running a country like this, you don't care about the people. You only care about them enough for them to live, to be able to produce the stuff you need for free for you. So you can make the things you are going to sell to your market. in Europe, right? So how did they make this work? They did four things. One is they took over the lands. So all the farmers, all the producers, everyone had to pay tax to the British government, whatever you want to call them, right? The crown. Let's call them the crown. So one, you're paying tax to them. Number two, they're dictating what you will grow. So you don't have a choice. They tell you grow poppy or grow indigo. Don't grow rice and wheat. Guess what? You have famines every 20 years, right? Which you remember, Bengal famine, this famine, that famine. Mm-hmm. They killed millions of people in India. So they decide production, right? They don't leave anything to you. There's no freedom there. Third, they will buy, quote unquote, buy your produce without paying you. Okay, so they will say the crown is taking over your production this year. We have told you what to build. You will get a small fee for your pain. You are not getting the full value of what you produced. So they didn't pay the market price for indigo, opium, whatever, cotton, whatever they were taking from the land. Okay, so three things, remember. They're taxing you. They're dictating what you produce. They are taking your produce for nothing, for pennies. And then fourth, they are taking the raw material back to the UK, making the cloth and whatever there, and then bringing it back here and forcing you to buy that. It was illegal for Indians to buy cloth from Indian producers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now you tell me, is any of this good for the country? No, it's not. It's the simplest, most efficient way to rape the place. Right? And it's a great stock to own, by the way. If you could buy East India stock, anyone bought it back then. They created the whole stock market concept for a company of this quality.
Yeah, I've heard Robert Clive, if I'm getting the name right, I think Robert Clive, many of the people who were, the generals became multimillionaires.
And by the way, they've changed their last names. They're all still in London, by the way. They've changed their last names. They've become philanthropic foundations. But you can trace the ancestry back to these governors of Bengal, governors of the Deccan, governors of Delhi, governors of the Punjab. The guy who founded Yale University, okay, Yale, one of the universities in the world. That fellow was a governor of Madras.
Madras,
he took slaves from Tamil Nadu to the cotton plantations of eastern USA to continue his very obvious and pleasant life and quality of living. Right? And no one talks about Yale as a slave owner and a devastator, clearly a devastating economic agent from India's point of view. So the reality of the economic argument here is they did so much damage over 300 years that it's still hard to verbalize what this has done to people of this country. These are generational scars. Okay, I mean, you may not have stories in your family, but I know people who have hard to recover from scars about what this system did to them. So I think for us to say, oh, they were also good, they left the train tracks and so on. They built trains more efficiently, take stuff from the middle of the country to the ports. They didn't build trains so that we can have faster transit times as Indians, right? They didn't build ports so that India's economy improves. They built ports so that they can get our stuff that they took for free faster out of India, right? Definitely, they did not keep the kingdoms and so on fighting with each other because, oh, they were trying to make lives for us somehow better. No, they were keeping them fighting with each other because it's in their interest for the kings of India, quote unquote, whatever was left of them, to fighting each other instead of uniting and fighting against the British. Right? So all of these are very simple economic arguments to make, but people get more caught up in the emotional side of things. So the logic usually leaves the argument. Again, look, I don't blame them for this. It's a great stock to own. I'm saying it for the fifth time, but it's wrong. You know, ethically, it's the worst thing you can do to a people. And clearly what they did to the Africans is even worse. But again, we have to learn from this, make sure it never happens to us again, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, so obviously, I think I need to, I had, so there is this professor called Vinay Lal, who teaches in the US. So he uploads a lot of Indian history lectures online. I have checked out a few of those, but I obviously need to brush up my Indian history a little more.
We all do. I think we've done a big disservice in school where we're taught a very Nehruvian version of history, which is very whitewashed. And Ashoka is a great emperor, and Nehru's Chacha Nehru with Children's Day on his birthday and so on. These are all made up stories. Okay, history isn't really what's in the textbook. It's a very selected narrative about what they think we should know. so that we don't ask too many questions. If we see the way the events actually unfolded, and three levels of history, the economic part of history, the societal part of history, and the civilizational part of history, right? There's always three aspects. Societal is more day-to-day, who's in charge, who's related to who, what king, what queen, whatever. But civilizational is more the traditions that were being passed on, the philosophical way of thinking, the systems, not just the people. So I think if you look at all three, you've seen massive swings in India's history, which people don't want to talk about for whatever reason. And I think that's where we get very biased views of history, a very narrow part of one narrative that is convenient for a certain set of people.
So I want to stay here for a second. So I think I have a few speculative questions here.
Please.
Right. So this is something even like bothers me as well. Because in my opinion, I think this is the view that you just mentioned. I think it is still a very minority view, and I don't know, for some reason, I keep going back to the three decades post Nehru. I feel those are like in my mind, like those are the wasted decades. But there's still, but in general, there still seems to be a lot of reverence for that period and a lot of nostalgia for that period and a lot of, let's say, a testament of great leadership that was shown during that period. And whenever I hear those statements, I'm just clueless. I don't know where that's coming from.
I agree.
Any theories there?
I think Nehru's kind of guy who wrote his own press releases. So very clearly, he's a guy who actively pursued the setting of the narrative about him, right? Was it the children of India who decided to call him Chacha Nehru? No, he put that title on himself, okay? He would make school children sing a song about Chacha Nehru when as a prime minister, he would visit schools, whatever, for the show and tell. He gave them a song to sing for him, okay? This is the kind of guy who, he said he made his birthday Children's Day for India. Did anyone vote for that? Was it a parliamentary decision? No, he just decided, I want my birthday to be called Children's Day, right?
Mm-hmm.
He named roads and airports and ports and all after himself while he was alive. So I think, and of course, his family, there's a whole narrative about that. I don't want to become too political on this conversation, but very clearly, it's a behavior that is very actively installed by him and then the people who come after him from his family, right? Indira Gandhi had a very similar frame of mind. So I think I'm not surprised that the few people who have benefited from the Nehruvian system of running India still talk very fondly about when he was around. Right? It was great for them. It was a great life for them. They were quoted in media every day. Their faces was in the newspaper. There were only three newspapers in India. They controlled all of it. They didn't allow all the smaller newspapers who were around who won us freedom. If you look at the revolutionary past of India, all those were made to shut down. They were forced to be silent. I think a lot of stifling of freedoms, control, voice, and therefore a very good life for those people in power. Right? I also think that a lot of Indian history is North Indian history. If you look at what is happening in the South, was the South happy with Nehru? Absolutely not. Right?
Mm-hmm.
The South was always of the opinion it's a very illegitimate prime minister. Sardar Patel was very clearly a guy who had more consensus because he had spent time in the South taking care of the issues we had here for real, right? For example, Nizam of Hyderabad was refusing to be a part of India, right? The Goan kingdom was still with the Portuguese, and even after our independence, we had to slowly bully them out of our land, right? The French in Pondicherry and so on. There's an issue with Sri Lanka. There was an issue with the Telangana region, the border of Bengal and Bangladesh. There were a lot of issues that Patel was solving. I'm giving you as an example of someone else who was actually solving problems people of India faced.
Mm-hmm.
Right? As Nehru was very clearly in Delhi, around Gandhi, just four or five people, building very strong consensus for him as the prime ministerial candidate. So I think, look, people remember all this. When you refer to us, there's a majority view that likes Nehru and a minority view that doesn't. It's actually the other way around. Regular people in India, like regular citizens, don't have very fond memories of Nehru. Okay, a lot of people who are taught history go out there and read a book, know that, okay, the history in the textbook is wrong. Right? They get angry. Why is the school teaching me garbage? Why is the school teaching my children garbage? Right? So there's real anger about why our history is whitewashed. I don't agree with you that it's a, my view is a minority view. My view is a view of anyone who's read a real book, not a history textbook prescribed by our system that was clearly designed to give us one version of history.
So a few points. So first of all, I think I can get a little political here, in the sense that, so I think the people that I hang out with, mostly liberals, I think they tend to like, I think that's, I think.
I'm a liberal too, by the way. I'm not some ultra conservative, go to the church and pray five times a day kind of guy, right? I'm so, also liberal.
Like my money,
honest.
Sorry?
You make more money as a liberal, to be honest.
Oh, like, I don't know. Like, I think the friends, the liberals that I hang out with, most of them, like, generally favor Nehru. Like, and I don't know, even I call myself a liberal, but I have never been of that view. So I have generally noticed liberals kind of, like, really fawning over Nehru and during that time.
True.
Yeah, so that's where I was coming from. And
fair question, Ryan. And, you know, there's a term in politics, in political science, called the useful idiot. Okay, where if you read how an outside government can take over another government surreptitiously, like through secret covert intelligence operations and so on, one of the first things they do is they convert a set of intelligent people, the intelligentsia, like academics, media people, journalists, etc., they convert them into their way of thinking. Okay. And they call them the useful idiots because they will keep parroting whatever narrative you give them, and they will convert a large number of people below them who take their work, their word as truth, while you have to do almost nothing for your agenda to become mainstream in that country, right?
Mm-hmm.
For example, we've had a lot of useful idiots who are still communists at age 70, age 80, right? And part of the parties, communist parties of India. Their system has failed miserably everywhere in the world. Even China has discarded very fundamental principles of communism, right, on the economic side. But they refuse to accept reality, right? They'll send their kids to Stanford and Harvard and teach them and tell them to go become investment bankers in the US. But they'll come here and talk about communism and control and, you know, the democracy is bad and this and that, and we should not have companies and we should have more taxes and so on. So these are like basic hypocrites, okay? Like they call useful idiots, to be polite. But it's basic hypocrisy. So I'm not surprised your network of liberals, a lot of them are useful idiots. So they're parroting a narrative that isn't real.
I did like that term, useful idiots. Another term, another, like, not a term, but a belief that I hold is like how you mentioned the useful idiots. I feel like, and this may be a digression, which is like, I feel like JNU, the JNU University, I feel is like a place where talent goes to rot, where like people go and study, but nothing really happens there. And I mean, nothing happens to the students, that kind of happens there. So that was like one more.
It's right. We have that perception. I don't know if you study arts. I'm an engineer. I don't know what you studied. But I think as a society, we sneer down on people who go and study arts, right? History, language, political science, whatever. I actually find that's a problem. I think we should have more respect for people who come out of JNU. We should have more respect for people who study arts and language and so on. And they should improve society, right? They should bring new ways of thinking, better ways of governing, better ways of assembling human beings into systems. They should enrich our lives, right? At least that's a theory. But actually what they come out as, unfortunately, because of what they are taught in those universities by Marxists, the academics are all to blame, very Marxist people. They teach them, they are taught very zero-sum thinking, right? They are taught Marxism is the only way to live and govern a country because people are inherently evil. I think that's a very flawed circular argument, right? Marxism creates evil people because you're taking away freedoms, you're creating scarcity, you're giving people control to and power to a few people on the top. They'll never stay uncorruptible. They'll always be corrupted by power. Human beings are human beings in the end. No one is a Superman. So Marxism creates evil. Right, it's a loop that designs it. Right, it's just conceptually, but they'll refuse to accept that, and they'll keep parroting that for the rest of their life, often to their own detriment. Right, they don't become very successful professionally, they don't create jobs, they don't create big value. Our GDP growth, really, we have to become 5 trillion, 10 trillion. We should be at 10,000 per capita GDP. All that stuff is, in reality, in truth, good for us. Right, it's foolish to argue against economic prosperity. But these guys will refuse to accept that. They won't even debate you. They'll attack you instead. They won't attack what you're saying. But you're this guy, but you're this guy's son, but you're, you know, you're a privileged caste, whatever. They'll just go in all weird places to attack you. They'll never debate the argument. So I think we have been let down by our liberal arts education. So I don't just blame the students or the people. I think, unfortunately, arts education in India has to be redesigned fully.
I want to take a step back now to a few things that you mentioned earlier. One is, so I think at the beginning of the conversation, we alluded to the idea of India. Like, you know, if we ask ourselves, like, what is India as well? It's a very complicated story. Also, just I think a minute or so back, you also touched on like this idea of North India, South India. Bringing it together, how, like, in terms of, like, let's say economics per se, on the ability of India to grow as a nation, I'm not seeing like North India or South India being that big of a problem. Is that fair of me to, is that a fair assessment, where even though we might have divisions or not work together, maybe, and that's also an assumption I'm making, but it's not so bad that it's going to affect, let's say, GDP growth, or it's going to be such a big factor. Is that fair of me to assume that?
I think it's fair. I think on multiple levels, I don't think, I actually think North and South and West and East and all the regional, you know, lines, however we can draw the lines, language and all of that stuff. I think largely we've become quite comfortable being one country. Okay. I truly think, you know, for example, in Tamil Nadu, they should talk very violently about rejecting Hindi and we'll be a separate country if we have to be, etc. in the 60s and 70s. That's almost gone now. Like, even they are bored of saying that stuff, right? Of course, they'll, once in a while, Hindi becomes an issue. That's not going to go away. But now, should we be a separate country, etc.? All that is gone. Right? People are tired of that argument. So I think we've reached a point where it's actually a good thing to be an Indian. And lastly, there's consensus that this is our territory. This is how we should be. So people support Article 370, for example, en masse. They want Kashmir to be a full part of India. They will not take the Chinese incursion on our borders in the Northeast lightly. They want the army to fight if it comes to that. So I think even in the South. So I think it's become fairly consensus. I don't think we have the risk of India becoming this, people calling for different Indias and so on.
I wanted to touch on, so again, this is a speculative one. In terms of like continuity of governance. So I'll tell you where I'm coming from. I think my view is mostly a little biased because of the US, in the sense that US presidents in general have two terms. So they get elected once and they can get re-elected once more, and it's a 4-year term. You can do it twice and then you're out. Doesn't matter how old you are, and
there's no term limit. That's a misconception. Washington stepped down after the second term, so no one ever who's their first president, right? No one has ever wanted to defy that practice and stand for a third term. So it's actually no, there's no term. It's actually just a practice now.
I think I would disagree with you, because I think it's actually encoded in the, I think they actually do have a law, but people should fact check on this. I'm not sure, because my recollection is, you can check yourself as well. My recollection is, I think in the 30s or 40s, they had enacted this law that you can only serve.
Sorry, the original constitution didn't have it. They changed it in some amendment, a 22nd amendment. My bad. I remember they have it because when we were doing our constituent assembly, I read a book about our constituent assembly, our design of our constitution. There was a big debate about should we have term limits, and if people want to vote, why can't they vote, and so on. And the American system had a large influence on us. Sorry, my bad.
Yeah. So I think in the 30s, my memory is also a little hazy. I think in the 30s, they implemented this amendment. Right. You can only have two. Perfect. So I'm just wondering, actually, I like that. I like the idea that people can serve like limited amount of terms and, you know, have power for a limited number of years. Again, going back to my criticism of Nehru again, I think he was prime minister for about, I don't know, 15 years, 17 years. Right. I mean,
that's right.
I feel that is just ridiculous that one person is ruling for like almost close to 2 decades. That doesn't make any sense at all. And I don't think it's healthy as well. For new talent to come in, and for new leaders to kind of develop as well. So just wanted to get your view, like how you think about this. Like, obviously you mentioned, like, I mean, people, if people like a guy and they want to keep voting him to power, then obviously it's their prerogative or their right to do so. How are you approaching it? Any thoughts on that in general?
I actually agree with the system we have, where with the system the US has, where there's a fixed number of terms, and you know, there's clearly a regulation against standing for too long. I truly have reached a conclusion that after a while, power corrupts everyone. No one is incorruptible, and I'm not willing to assume there's an exception at any point in time. How do I know? Right? There's no way to test it. So I think having term limits is actually a very good thing. It's a very modern solution. Also, by the way, you know, historically, if you look at how human beings have governed themselves, there's hereditary king passing to a son and whatever. We've liked continuity, at least we've preferred continuity from a system point of view. I like that we have forced discontinuity so that we are required to find new leaders, for people to win our trust as a leader, so we vote for them. I think it's a healthier for democracy compared to just allowing people to run forever.
Any thoughts on, like we discussed, like any thoughts on what could go wrong for India today? I mean, for...
Yeah, it's a good question. So look, it's undeniable. The last 10 years have been very good for India economically. We've also passed a lot of legislation on very unpopular topics like Kashmir and a whole bunch of things that were very important. But someone had to make a decision, and these guys have done it, right? So I think the people of India, if I look at the people I know, and I'm just one citizen, one vote. But if I look around and I ask myself what kind of consensus is forming, when we have a leader that takes difficult decisions, oftentimes very unpopular with a section of people, but they're very clearly obvious decisions that have to be made. That decision has to be made. You can't keep avoiding the decision. I think people respect leadership. That is real leadership, right? And people build a trust around someone who can make those difficult decisions continuously. So there have been a lot of difficult decisions that have been made, which has cleared a backlog of like mental fatigue about being Indian. Okay. Ayodhya and a bunch of things. Now, you know, we can all disagree about the decisions, but at least the decisions are made, right? Now, et cetera. Now, if I zoom out and I think objectively, do I trust the same people to remain the same way for longer? It's hard for me to buy that logic, right? Whoever they are, however good they've been, whatever consensus has formed, it is hard for human beings to be capable of making such difficult decisions at that level with that kind of scrutiny at that intensity for this long. Okay. So very naturally, we're already hearing, you know, rumors that this will be, if this prime minister stands again, it'll be the last time he stands. He may let go in the middle of the term, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not surprised. I'm really not surprised that it is pushing the human limit too far. Okay. It is not an easy thing to run this country, by the way. It is one of the toughest jobs in the world. And definitely winning an election in this country is mind-bendingly difficult. But I think there's a natural limit even this prime minister will reach. Now, I am very concerned about a whiplash in policy that may retard a lot of the progress we made as an economy. Right? Now, again, forget the economic argument, which party is in power. Right? As an investor, I want whichever party is in power, win a democratic election, you know, all that is fine. Say what you have to do, win your votes, whatever. The drama will continue. Once you're in power, you have to do what's best for the country. Not for yourself, not for your cronies, not for your ideology, not for your, you know, your family, whatever. A lot of economic policy, therefore, is quite obvious, whichever ideology you believe in. Okay, we should give incentives for job creation. We should allow education in India to be more, you know, inclusive, more IITs, more seats, or forget IITs, more universities, more quality education. We should incentivize, you know, for example, women want to get jobs, whatever, give them incentives, give them tax breaks. We should incentivize manufacturing in India. Why are we still importing plastic from China? Why are laptops not made here, et cetera, et cetera. So a lot of obvious things that we have to set up, economic policy. And then I can go obvious on other things. We need a strong army. We need a strong defense. We need strong you know, missiles, rockets, planes, you know, fighter jets, whatever. We have to spend money to we have to invest to become a big country. We have to keep compounding. So economic policy for the largest part is fairly obvious. Okay, like it would be foolish to just do the opposite of this government, because then we will actually grow slower. It'll hurt us as a GDP, it'll hurt us as individuals, right? So I'm concerned one of the big risks politically is this government has been around for so long. If they lose, I don't know what the elections are going to be like. No one can predict. But if they lose, I'm afraid that there'll be a lot of policy retardation simply for the sake of it. Okay? And no one should be happy with that. Whether you voted for this guy, that guy, whoever you voted for, it doesn't matter. If your economic well-being is going to be hurt, that is a problem. Okay? So I think that's a big risk. And it's inevitable a different party will come to power, right? And this, our Indian democracy has been quite punishing that way. It removes incumbents quite efficiently. So I don't know if 2024, it could be another election. I don't know. I can't predict the future. But one day we will have a different party, different whatever. We'll have different ideologies in power. I'm very concerned about economic policy continuity. Second thing I was very concerned about when I came back is the confidence of Indians was at an all-time low when I was in college. So Bombay, we had those Pakistanis come on a boat. China was creating a problem. We had the Great Recession. The Great Recession. We had a bunch of our stock market companies run into trouble, and the markets weren't doing great. So I think I myself have lived through, I mean, comparatively, one of the periods of India at the lowest point of its confidence. Right? We had a weak prime minister. He couldn't talk, you know, enough to comfort all of us when we were attacked by these terrorists and so on. So I lived through that, right? Now, I never want to live through a period of low confidence as an Indian again. Okay, I like a confident India. I like young people liking to be Indian. I like the world respecting what this country does. I like, you know, our sports teams winning things. I'm asking for too much, but I like my country succeeding, right? Second thing I'm concerned is we cannot succeed economically if our younger generations, sub 35, lose their confidence for any reason. Okay, and a lot of things can be announced and a lot of things can be done to shake confidence in young people, right? I'm very concerned about that. I don't know if any leader has convinced me about doing enough for our confidence. At least not yet, but I'm very sensitive to this point. It bothers me every day. And that's why I think even like Shark Tank, for example, I would be the first guy to say it's fantastic Shark Tank happens because so many people get a shot to come up there, talk about what they're doing. They may or may not get money. That's a secondary matter. But I love seeing like some housewife from Ujjain making earthen pots, raising 1.5 crores, goes back to Ujjain, a hero. A lot of people buy from her. I love those stories. Right? I love seeing Indians make it in whatever small way. Right? It matters. I think if we go through a confidence crisis, I think it's going to be a big, big problem. I don't know how we recover. It takes a long, long time. And third, I think from a population standpoint, we've reached our peak. I think 1.7 will be our peak. Our population replacement rate is already below. It's 2.1. It'll go to 2. So we are not going to make enough people to keep the population growing the same way. So number of new babies born is flatlined already at 25 million a year. So I think we are reaching a point where population is not going to be added at the same rate. Therefore, population growth is not going to be the same. So you'll actually start seeing a slowly shrinking India, right? And a slowly aging India. I don't know what happens when 500 million people in India cross 50. Okay, it's a big problem. We don't have enough hospitals. We don't have enough doctors, nurses. We need more young people earning more, paying more tax. We need our companies to be better, more efficient. We need a lot of resource reallocation because such a large, we've always had a majority young population. We are slowly going to go into a majority elderly population. Slowly, right? It's going to be 50 years, 30 to 50 years. I think that's a shift we are not prepared for. Now, China is going through the shift. It has rocked them to the core, right? You're seeing it already. The average age is getting up to the late 30s, early 40s. I think we are not prepared for that, at least today. That concerns me a lot. All the other stuff, interim wars, border disputes, and so on, I think we're strong enough, we'll work through all of that. But these are like big, scary things that I don't have answers to.
I think the confidence issue, I agree with you in the sense that I have like my friends as well who are, there is no shame. I think there used to be that shame of like being an Indian. shame is the wrong word, maybe at least the hesitancy. But now, correct. Yeah. But now there is nothing of that sort. And, you know, you get to see it in very implicit ways, like, you know, WhatsApp status, people are very openly, you know, there is no hesitancy of being an Indian and sharing, you know, being patriotic per se. Simple things like, you know, most viewed live streaming on YouTube was Chandrayaan's launch. So those things also kind of, you know, it shows that India is kind of united in these things. They're all together. So I think it kind of means a lot. And it also, it's also a nice thing, you know, it's also a nice thing to know that your country is also doing well on a global stage. When you see, I don't know, when you see the prime minister doing extremely well in, let's say, US tour or getting like standing ovation in like the capital. I think I want to close here with the Indian story. Is there anything you want to add? I mean, in the sense that, is there anything that you wanted to touch on which I didn't bring up? That's what I meant.
Yeah, I'll close by saying one thing on where I see the next 5 to 10 years, right? Now, to answer your original question about India shining and are we really at a different point in history now? Having been through hell pre-independence, having been through stagnation post-independence, having been painted into a corner in 1991, having stumbled onto 8% plus compounding into the fifth largest economy over the next 32 years in 2023, we're bigger than the UK now, we're bigger than France, we'll grow past Germany, we'll go past Japan. Only US and China will be number one, number two ahead of us, right? I think we have to pause for a moment and understand how much we've been through to get here. Okay. And I think that is the only thing that will give us urgency for not wasting the next 10 to 15 years. I think a lot of us, you know, I'm sub 35, so I can talk about us as us. But people sub 35 have not, I don't know if they spend enough time understanding the pain we've been through, right? And what it means to be 3.5 trillion in GDP, whatever we are today. I think we can't take that for granted. If we take that for granted, we are not going to be as ambitious as we can for 3.5 to say 10 trillion, like a three times from here. I think this is also a decade that happens. I think this is the last decade that Indians can say in 10 or 15 years, we tripled our economy. Okay, we could say that last decade, right? We went from 1 trillion to 3 trillion. In our life, you and I were in college, school, whatever. From then to us becoming adults, we went from 1 trillion to 3 trillion, right? A tripling. We have one more tripling ahead of us, which is fantastic. And this is a bigger tripling from 3 to 10. Like 10 is like scary, like big shit, right? Now you're the only country in the world after US and China that has grown past 10. No one has come here before you. No one else has come here before you, right? So I think at 10, we are a very different country. We're a very different animal. Countries are scared of us. We are imposing us a little bit more on other smaller countries. The bigger countries can't screw around with our borders. Pakistan will be a non-entity by then. It's already a nuisance today. Like, we can ignore them. It'll be a non-entity by the time we're 10, right? So I think there's a lot of things here that, like, we will just be a very different country, okay? We can also lose historical perspective and a grounding as a result. And if we lose our grounding, then we're not going to make full use of this path. We'll do it too slow. We'll lose track. We'll lose focus. We'll lose confidence. So we have to know our history. We have to know where we've come from. We have to have some sympathy with the pain. We can disagree on, you know, was this a big deal or was it not a big deal? Fine, right? Everyone disagrees. But we can't ignore the facts. Okay, everyone should know the facts. They can draw their own conclusions. If we have an understanding of our historical facts and then we put into context this next tripling that's coming, I don't think any Indian is going to feel like it's not great to be Indian or, you know, I want to leave India. I think this decade, you will make the most out of it over the last 3 or 4 generations have in this country. So I think I'm very excited. I think the more I read about our history, the more I am very clearly seeing this is a very unique window of time for all of us. So I hope, and I'm definitely going to work harder, but I hope all of us make full use of it.
Final comment, like, I think it's really sad what's happened to Pakistan. Like, I think there was a time when India and Pakistan were like considered like neck to neck. And I mean, what's happened to that country is like tragic, where now, like you said, right, it's close to a nuisance where, you know, the gap is so large that it's become irrelevant at this point. It's really scary what can happen to nations in like a few decades. Anyways, at this point, I want to close the India talk. I just have a few more very general questions that I'd like to get through. And yeah. So I'm very curious, how often do you vacation?
Maybe once a year. Haven't taken a vacation for a while, actually.
And if I can probe, like, is it like generally out of India, or is it in India, or?
No, I think the last vacation I took outside of India was my honeymoon. After that, I just loved being like touring different parts of the country. So me and my wife doing a lot in India, actually. Almost all of it is in India, actually. We've gone to the World Cup in Qatar. So I guess that was like the only thing I would say is an exception.
Any vacation planned in the next few months? Or?
Yeah. I'm a father now, so I have to take my kids to our family temple in Goa. So I'm looking forward to that. I will be planning a few trips to different parts of India. Like, I'm going to visit some universities in Delhi, in Jaipur, in Coimbatore. So I'm trying to bundle like 2 days of non-work time when I go to places like this. I'm doing a lot more with college students now, just to talk about what we are seeing. So I'm looking forward to that. It's a lot of travel.
Do you work on the weekends, or is that strictly like family time?
Most of it is family time, but my work bleeds into all hours. So I'm tolerating that until maybe I'm a certain age. After that, I will not tolerate it. So I've also set a break point for until when that's okay. It is not going to be okay after a point.
And the number of hours that you work, is it like crazy hours, or is it like a very...
14 hours a day.
I'm so sorry?
14 to 15 hours a day.
Understood. Any workout sessions or?
Yeah. I do at least 45 minutes of exercise per day.
Morning or evening?
Usually in the morning. Sometimes if it's a rushed morning, in the evenings.
What time do you wake up?
Usually by 6:30. No choice. My son will just like smack my face and wake me up. So now there's no choice.
Fair enough. Any TV show that you're watching now?
So I was a big fan of The Billions show. I think it's on Hotstar. Yeah. They come back with a new season. I need to catch up. I've lost track of that. But I like the main guy. I think he left. He's come back now. So I'm looking forward to that. I think I'll find some time in September. That, and there's a show called Succession that I really liked the first season. I think a lot has happened. I saw Twitter went like totally crazy. I'm looking forward to catching up with that as well. But those are the two more recent shows I was liking. Those are two very, really interesting stories.
Favorite shark? Yeah.
What shark? On the show?
Yeah.
Indian show or the US show?
Indian show.
Indian show I have not watched too much. I liked the Bharat Pay founder when he was there. I mean, I disagree with a lot of what he said, but I like his style. It does very well on TV. So it was at least entertaining. I like the board founder, Aman. He's a good guy. I know.
Aman, okay.
Yeah.
And you watched the US version as well, is it?
Oh yeah, I used to, right? I was there. It became a fairly big hit on YouTube. They started putting the clips on YouTube. So I'm a big YouTube, like the one vice I have is I spend a little too much time on YouTube every week. So I, my YouTube history, do you know who KSI is in football, FIFA?
I have heard of KSI, but I don't know what he does. But
yeah,
I know.
He's UK's biggest YouTuber now. Like, he's a boxer, he's a rapper, he's in movies. He's built like an entire entertainment career out of streaming really hilarious videos on YouTube when he played FIFA. So I play FIFA. It's the only video game I played for since 2005. For me, the YouTube has been like the place where I see culture change. So the sharks that I liked, I love Cuban. I think he's a really, I mean, he's a weird guy, but he's very entertaining again. I like seeing how he'll say no to like 90 things. He'll say yes to the most weirdest thing. So I like seeing when he says yes. It's quite rare. Also very entertaining.
I think I got to know about KSI when I think he had a fight with Jake Paul. I think that's when I got to know that.
The Elder Paul, right? I forget the Pauls, but the Elder Paul. He had a fight. They boxed twice or thrice. I think he won two. It was drawn one time. So he's still up. I like that guy. I really like his story. He's come from nowhere, and I saw him grow. Right, like there are some, you know, like Ryan. Now, like our interesting thing in culture, Ryan. When we were in school, looking up to Sehwag and Tendulkar and Ganguly and, you know, like Dravid and Kumble and Srinath and so on. They were like adults, right? Like big guys. You looked up to them. Now I'm you know, on the wrong side of 30, right? No, more than 30. I'm looking at the people who are at their peak now in cricket, football, whatever. My heroes, Ronaldo, Messi, like they're my age now. I'm just realizing Ronaldo's 37, Messi's 35 or 36. I'm a few years younger, but they're closer to my age now. And looking at the new kids, Saka and you know, Balogun and all, like, I follow football quite closely. I think of them as kids now, right? They're these kids. Like, even when I'm texting my friends, a lot of us who follow football, that kid just had a wonderful run. Look at this video. He shot a goal. Our vocabulary about the people we get excited by in culture has changed, right? Now they're kids. We should look up to them before. So I think even I'm going through this very weird transition out of what was relevant culture to me when I was growing up, and now I'm fully grown up and I can't say I'm growing up anymore. So I think that's an interesting transition. Everyone goes through that, obviously. Just a fun observation I've been making over the last decade.
Something that you hate about aging?
Something that I
hate about aging?
Something I hate about aging. I hate the narrative about aging. I think I'm actually getting really good at what I do. Very few people have spoken about the upsides of like growing up, growing old, right? You get much fiercer about your time. You're getting really good at what you do. Like you're seeing the compounding of your skills. You're also building... You know, you don't make too many new friends after a certain point, right? That's true for everyone. But you're getting much more focused about your priorities in life, family, money, family, profession, spirituality, if that's important, your culture and, you know, traditions and so on. And, of course, friends. So you start drawing lines very fast and much more efficiently. And you stop feeling sorry about, oh, I'm not spending enough time with him or her or whatever. So I think I'm disappointed by how afraid we are made about growing old. I'm actually looking forward to a lot of things I'm going to be doing, you know, in a few years. So I think just accepting aging, you know, don't make a big deal out of it. That's an interesting learning experience.
Any other YouTube recommendation besides KSI?
Yeah, I don't recommend KSI. Please don't make that my recommendation. I'm just saying. He was a very different guy when he started. So I enjoyed seeing him grow over the last 10 years. YouTube recommendations. I'm really liking this guy called David Goggins. Incredible guy. He's an athlete. His story is quite interesting. So I think he's really fun to watch. From India, I'm liking a lot of the Think School and a lot of the YouTube channels that talk about companies and investing and the economy. So I think Think School is doing a really good job. I'm really liking their work. I'm a big fan of a channel that's called the Why Files, WHY Files. It covers weird things about what's happened to human beings, like the Area 51 and the Roswell incident. And recently, the American Air Force released some YouTube video of UFOs, right? You may have seen that. So he talks about that. So like some of the weird things, like when there's no consensus today, Why Files. I look forward to that guy's videos quite a bit. So these are three recommendations I can make. Interesting channels.
Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Ryan. I really enjoyed it.